indeed, we will call our first case. Before I do that, the east wing of the Capitol has been recently renovated, and the court has just begun to sit here again. And one of the difficulties in the renovation has been to install a sound system that works appropriately. So we've had some difficulties. Difficulties are that the speakers fade in and out, and that's true of those attorneys at the lectern. Justices also fade in and out, and I was reminded because I could hear that I was fading out. So, if you're interrupted by people asking you to speak more clearly or to raise a lower lectern, we apologize, but it's not your fault. We've got a problem here. When you in the audience cannot hear someone, if you just raise your hand so we know that there's difficulty having people heard, that would be helpful to us. So now that the people who are going to argue know that we can't hear a word you're saying, but we encourage you to proceed anyway.
All the right to meaningful review.
Right, exactly. So I'll call 00-0541 Sierra State versus Harvey, Stephen Weiss, Assistant State Public Defender representing Mr. Harvey.
Thank you, Chief Justice. I'm arguing this case on behalf of a different attorney who was present on the briefs in the case, Ms. Margaret Maroney of our office. She's doing fine. She had a foot operation. She was just simply unable to be here today. Representing Mr. Leonard Harvey, who is the appellant petitioner in the case. This case today is a very important case. This case concerns the most fundamental of all our constitutional rights, the right to a trial by jury. The decision in this case today is going to go a long way toward preserving that right intact as it's been known through the centuries, or it's going to take a giant step toward eroding that right to the point where we would no longer recognize it. This case arose over an issue concerning proof of penalty enhancer for possessing with the intent to deliver a controlled substance within 1,000 feet of certain enumerated locations. In this particular case, the locations were specifically listed in the statute as a state, county, city, village, or town park. In the Court of Appeals and in its briefs, the state has already conceded that it must prove two elements in this penalty enhancer, two factual elements. First, that the place was one of the enumerated locations, i.e. one of those particular parks, and second, that the activity occurred within 1,000 feet of that enumerated location. The Court of Appeals accepted the state's concession in that fact. In this court, the state did slightly change its concession to suggest that there are two subparts of one element. I'll leave that to the Attorney General to explain why that would matter. Our position is that whether it's two independent facts or two subpart facts that lead to an element, conclusions that we need to reach legally are identical.
You don't think that that fact element issue makes any difference under Apprendi?
I do not, because Apprendi specifically, constantly, over and over again says that every fact necessary to prove an enhancement must be decided by the jury, and they didn't distinguish whether the penalty enhancer had three elements, two elements, or one element. They said every fact essential had to be proven to the jury.
And you take that to mean, or to encompass, adjudicative or evidentiary facts?
Yes.
Both?
Yes, absolutely. I think evidentiary facts and adjudicative facts, to my understanding, are one and the same.
I'm sorry, that was a misstatement on my part. That includes, in your judgment, adjudicative facts, evidentiary facts, as well as elements of the offense.
Yes, absolutely. The element is simply the fact. Or the element is, were you within 1,000 feet of the school? The fact, as far as measuring where you were, is the element. That's how you prove the element, I guess the element technically. would be the legal finding, and the fact would be how you prove and sustain your burden on the legal finding.
Right. I mean, traditionally there's a distinction between evidentiary facts, things that are testified to, etc., and elements of the offense.
Oh,
which
surely. Whether the sun was out or whether it was raining might be a fact that was being proven in the case for some purpose, going to credibility or some ancillary reason. But the ultimate fact to be found by the jury is the elemental fact. And the elemental fact in this case is, were you within 1,000 feet of one of the specifically statutorily enumerated locations?
So you take the position that the penalty enhancer is not one element which consists of subparts or facts that need to be proven, but contains two elements, that being the proximity and the other being the identity of the park?
I would take the position that it really doesn't matter how we define it for these purposes, because if it's two elements which require proof of two things to the jury's satisfaction beyond a reasonable doubt, we reach the same conclusion as if we say there are two predicate facts which allow the jury to conclude this element. Either case, the jury must make those two findings. So whether we call it two subparts of one whole or two independent parts that create a whole, I'm not sure what the difference is. Perhaps the Attorney General could elaborate further on that. My position is that both of those facts must be proven by the state to the jury beyond a reasonable doubt. In this
Mr.
case,
White, don't you think it's significant that the jury had to determine whether or not there was delivery within 1,000 feet of one of the enumerated parks, and the judge didn't say, you've got to make that finding, you've got to determine that based on what I'm telling you. All he said was that Penn Park is a city park and that you have to take that into consideration. Isn't that a major distinction? He's not telling them that they have to find that there was possession within 1,000 feet of a city park. He's merely telling them you have to take as proved that Penn Park is a city park. I think that's a major distinction, don't you?
I don't, Justice Crooks. The reason I don't is that by simply stating that this place, there's a piece of geography, a piece of land, and the state has the burden of proving that this piece of land is one of the specific pieces of land that the legislature has determined and triggers this penalty enhancer. There are many parks that the use of the word park in and of itself doesn't prove that it's one of the enumerated parks. All parks are not part of this statute. Miller Park, where the Brewers play, isn't included in this statute. UW Research Park out at Whitney Way is not included in this statute. It has to be a city park, a county park, a state park, a town park, or a village park. There's a case up in Marshfield a few years ago of a religious case where there was the 10-foot-tall religious statue in the middle of a Marshfield city park. And there was a lawsuit in federal court about separation of church and state and having a religious icon on the governmental park. And the way they dealt with that was they actually sold for a dollar or something a certain amount of the land around that park to a private landholder or foundation that was going to hold it in trust. And then they went back to federal court and said, well, that statue's not in our park anymore. It's on this private land. And they said, well, how do we know that? They said, oh, we put up a 4-foot-tall wrought iron fence around that piece of that land, and that land is no longer a state park or a city park. So I think that there are real factual questions here. When a judge says, well, you were within 1,000 feet of this place, and this place is a city park, the judge has made a factual finding that was certainly subject to some dispute, should the defense choose to do that. And, you know, as Justice Wilcox wrote in Perkins, and it's cited in our brief, in this case, no matter how overwhelming the evidence may be, a judge can never take a factual issue from the jury. When the judge does that, the judge is directing a verdict. And in this case, this judge said to the jury, I have found that the so-called place, Penn Park, is a city park, and you are directed, those are his exact words, you are directed to accept that as true. I can't think of anything more obviously a directed verdict on an elemental fact than that, Your Honor.
Let me ask you, if I might, a follow-up question. It's clear from the answers that you gave to Justice Sykes that you're depending, and also I think the briefs make it clear that you're depending upon the Apprendi case. And from what I've been able to tell, a number of courts, including the First Circuit, the First Federal Circuit, have basically found Apprendi inapplicable in situations where a penalty enhancer has not really been applied. Now, in this particular case, it's my understanding that your client was sentenced to 42 months and that the maximum sentence, forgetting about any enhancer, was 15 years. Doesn't that make Apprendi inapplicable to this situation?
No, and for two reasons, Justice Crux. First, I think Apprendi itself, and I understand there are some cases that are leaning that way, and I'm assuming that they're on their way for further review, because in Apprendi itself, if one reads the language of Apprendi, Apprendi was not premised simply on the fact that the maximum sentence actually exceeded the prior statutory maximum without the enhancer. Apprendi said probably five or six or seven different places that if it increases the maximum penalty range or it imposes the threat of greater imprisonment, it applies. And that's the language that was used throughout Apprendi. It never said when one receives a sentence. If you care to, I actually do have a few quotes I could cite to you in Apprendi. You can certainly review it for yourself. But the court said things like, any fact that increases the maximum penalty must be submitted to the jury and proven beyond a reasonable doubt. At another point, at page 484 in the U.S. cites of Apprendi, it's 530 U.S., and I'll just give you the page numbers. At page 484, there's a discussion where they go on, if the defendant faces an increased penalty. At page 490, they say, any fact that increases the maximum must be submitted to the jury. And at page 494, they say, does the required finding expose the defendant to a greater punishment? So the first side of that is I'm not sure that it's clear at all or that we want to take the approach that, well, we don't have to follow Apprendi in this situation because he was sentenced to something less than the original 10 years. The second part is that this penalty enhancer specifically also carries a mandatory minimum three-year incarceration. Normally, on this 42-month sentence, he would have been eligible for parole in less than 1 year. Because of this sentence and the application of this enhancer, the man is absolutely forced to remain in prison for a full 3 years, 36 months. This is an old law case. So I would certainly also assert that his penalty was greatly enhanced by virtue of the fact that he has to spend every day of 36 months in prison before he can even see the parole board. So for those two reasons.
You would rely on that particular fact also.
I would rely on both of them. I would rely on the legal theory that Apprendi applies when it increases the potential maximum. Number one, I would say number two, this man did suffer increased punishment by virtue of the mandatory 3 years.
Can the court find any adjudicative facts in the criminal case?
Certainly.
Can you give some examples?
Yeah, there are many facts that are not what I would consider, and for purpose of this argument, I'll just call them elemental facts or ultimate facts. If a witness is testifying that it was snowing and I was all bundled up when I went out, and because of the snow, if I had been near the house that got robbed, you would have seen footprints in the snow. And the other side wants to say, well, it was an exceptionally warm December day. It was going to be 63 degrees. There was no snow, and nobody was wearing a bundled-up coat. I think that they could certainly bring in weather facts from the meteorological, wherever place you get those facts, whatever it's called, and prove those facts through judicial notice to impeach that witness. And those are certainly adjudicative facts, in my opinion, but they're not elemental facts. And I think where we draw the line is where the finding of the judge actually takes an issue from the jury.
Well, I don't mean to be cute. here, but suppose Ms. Herman was the victim in a homicide case. Would it be the state's job to prove that she was a human being?
I think in a sense, yes, but I think by virtue of showing that she existed, they've proven that she's a human being. I've never quite considered that specific permutation, but again, I don't think that would be the fact. That's not a fact.
She wouldn't have been in court if she were dead.
But she existed. No, I mean, she existed prior to her demise.
What? How do we know she wasn't an alien?
Well, frequently, and I see that proven all the time. I've been involved in murder cases where the defense has tried to assert that they don't need to prove that this person was a human being with a photograph of the victim through the various phases of her life in front of the jury, and we've said, well, you don't have to prove that as a fact because by virtue of her existence, it's there. I'm not sure if that's a judicial notice situation exactly.
Well, the statute talks about giving the defense an opportunity, or I guess either party, the opportunity to challenge an adjudicated fact. Did that come into play here, and is that satisfactory or not?
No, it didn't come into play here because the state never presented any evidence on this fact whatsoever. And the posture of this case is that the state put on their evidence, never put on any evidence at all concerning what is this thing called Penn Park. And at that point, at the close of the state's case, the state realizing, I believe, that it had been in error, and let me back up just a second, in the original information in this case, case was tried upon, it listed Penn Park as a state park. The information says within 1,000 feet of Penn Park, a state park. At the close of the case, after presenting no evidence, the district attorney said to the trial judge, Your Honor, I need to amend the information. I believe Penn Park is a city park, and I'd like to amend the information to conform with the proof, although our position is there was no proof, that it's a city park. And at that point, the defense counsel responded by, number one, objecting to the amendment, and number two, moving for a directed verdict of not guilty on the penalty enhancer, specifically arguing that there was no proof ever made of what this geographic place was. And it was at that moment that the judge said, well, I can just take judicial notice of this, and of course, you know, Penn Park is a city park, and I'm just going to take notice. The district attorney, even at that point, said, I think we're getting into a little dicey area here. District attorney said, Judge, please, let's reopen the case. It'll just take me a minute. I have a witness here, and it'll take 1 minute for me to put on evidence about Penn Park. And the judge, not even heeding the warning of the DA, who specifically said, I don't want this issue floating around later. The judge said, no, I can take judicial notice. Let's move on.
Counsel?
So, if that answered you, Justice Presser, I didn't mean to interrupt, just that there was no opportunity, there was no evidence to refute. In a criminal trial, the burden is on the state to prove everything. If they don't prove it, you're entitled to a directed verdict of not guilty, which is the posture of this case.
But that's why I was going to the question of a human being in a first degree or major homicide case. I would suspect that the state put in evidence that the victim is a human being in the normal course of events.
I think they do, Your Honor. I think they do in every single murder case, as I was trying to say, by virtue of the fact that there was a person who was engaged in some activity or living in some place who was killed. I think those are facts from which the jury can readily infer that the person was a human. In other words, I've never seen a murder case where the victim wasn't identified as being a person, and once somebody said, well, I used to have a sister and her name was Mary, I think from that fact they can readily infer
if
proof of a human being.
There are repeated references in the testimony to Penn Park. Isn't it reasonable to infer that that's a park?
Absolutely not. As I said, we could talk about Miller Park all summer long. And Miller Park is not a park, and Miller Park is not covered by the statute. Nor is UW Research Park, nor is Arlington Park, the racetrack down in Illinois. Nor is that chunk of this park with the religious statue in Marshfield. Those are not parks within the meaning of this statute. So simply saying Penn Park proves nothing, Judge.
Justice Ballard. I'm sorry, Justice Bradley.
Thank you, Chief. As a follow-up to Justice Prosser's question, assume that it is capable of being judicially noticed, but that the trial court, as alleged here, did not articulate the basis for taking judicial notice. What precludes an appellate court on review from taking judicial notice of the fact, assuming that it is one that is subject to judicial notice?
Assuming that it's a fact subject to judicial notice, there's authority indicating that an appellate court can take notice of that fact. We would dispute that this is the type of fact that falls within there. There's a separate issue in the case. There was some issue as to whether there was a waiver of review or not, sort of a backup position that if you decide to allow judicial notice of elements, what are the proper procedures within the court's discretion? The Court of Appeals certainly addressed that issue, and the briefs addressed that issue. And that when taking judicial notice at the trial level, since there are two parties present, you're supposed to, I believe, allow the parties an opportunity to comment on the facts and the basis for the judicial notice.
For instance.
Please. I was going to suggest that even in the appellate court situation, presumably before the court was making its judicial notice fact finding, the parties would have had input into that through briefs. The proponent of the judicial notice would have made some argument that the respondent or opponent of the judicial notice position would have had an opportunity to respond to, such as of the underlying premise or the documents, the reliability, that sort of thing. So even in that sense, I think there's still an opportunity for a party to be heard on the judicial notice issue.
But even if this court were to determine assuming that we determine that it is a fact that is capable of being subject to judicial notice. But let's say we determine that the circuit court erroneously exercised its discretion in failing to set forth the basis upon which it took judicial notice. Can't we just supply that basis? Is there anything to preclude us from doing that as an appellate court?
At the risk of sounding glib, there's nothing that would prevent this court from doing what it wishes to do in a situation like that. I would certainly argue strongly that the better practice would be, if the court were even considering doing that, to remand the case to allow the parties an opportunity to be heard on the propriety of judicial notice and the discretion to be exercised on what basis. Again, there is no basis to determine in this record where that fact came from, other than Justice Prosser suggesting, well, they call it a park.
Let's assume that we agree with you that this park is, in its present form in this record, not subject to judicial notice. What's the remedy you're seeking?
In this case, it would be a vacation of the penalty enhancement. The conviction for possession of a controlled substance with the intent to deliver is not touched by this. Strictly that portion with the special verdict was this within 1,000 feet of Penn Park. And it would basically mean that the defense was correct and it should have been granted the directed verdict at the trial stage on that issue.
What happens to the sentence?
The sentence itself, in most Let me back up just a second. I have asserted in cases myself that when there is an enhanced sentence where the enhancer is gone, there should be an argument made for resentencing. These days, the law is somewhat unclear. In some cases, within discretion of the appellate court or the Supreme Court, it's been remanded for resentencing in light of the reduced maximum. In other cases, if the sentence did not exceed the maximum, as Justice Brooks was mentioning, then the sentence simply stands, but the enhancer is removed. The third option at that point is that if counsel felt there was a reason to then return to the trial court on a modification of sentence motion based upon new information. In other words, well, Judge, this is no longer an enhanced case. He wasn't facing 15 years, and in your sentencing remarks you said he should get half of the maximum, which is 7.5. I would certainly return to the trial court and suggest to the judge that the max is now 10, and half of 10 would be 5, and seek a sentence reduction. But I think it would simply be a matter of discretion. I think there's a hard and fast rule.
How much time has he served at this point?
At this point, he has served, just give me one moment. He was sentenced in July of 1999, so 2001. He served approximately 2.5 years because there was some, I think, 100 and some odd days of jail credit that's not reflected on the judgment, which is in the brief, but there was a separate order awarding him some jail credit after the fact. So he'd be, at this point, he's passed his initial parole eligibility. He has not reached the 3-year point. He's getting closer to it. And he also had 2 small consecutive misdemeanor sentences, which had 10 months. So his total sentence was 52 months, 42 of which were attributable to this case. The court has other questions. I would just like to conclude just by giving an example of what I think the court could do rather than what the court should not have done in this case as far as a verdict. And I think that it'll maybe help make it clear about the difference between an element and just a fact. If this court wanted to define, if the trial court had wanted to define the element and say, well, under this statute, a park means the following things. It means a city park, and a city park is defined as ABC, a state park is defined as DEF, etc., and gone on and simply said that to the jury, but then left it to the jury to determine whether Penn Park, this place, was one of those locations, I don't think we'd be here today. I think at that point the judge was simply giving the jury the law that the jury needed to determine whether this geographic location fits within this statute, was this specific kind of park.
Except there was no evidence in the record about the status.
That's why we're here, Your Honor, because the state failed to prove what kind of park it was. I was suggesting that the way it could have worked out and how far a judge could go would be so far as to define the element park, not by saying this place is a park within the statute, but by telling the jury, within this statute, park means the following, and if you feel that the state has proven that this place was a park, as I've defined park for you, then you can go ahead and find that Penn Park is a state park or a city park. But anything further than that, the judge is deciding the case, not the jury.
That would be erroneous exercise, is what you're saying. I'm talking about as far as the judge using the judicial, taking judicial notice, that it would be that he erroneously exercised his discretion doing that?
No, I believe it's much more serious than an erroneous exercise of discretion. I think what the judge did was he removed that issue from the jury, and in Perkins, you were very clear about where the jury goes and where the judge goes. So I think it's much more than an exercise of discretion. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Weiss. We'll now hear from Ms. Herman, who is an Assistant Attorney General, and she's representing the state of Wisconsin.
May it please the court. court. I am Assistant Attorney General Laura Herman, representing the state of Wisconsin. I'd like to clarify what this case is about and what it's not about. What we're really dealing with here is the constitutionality of the jury instruction found within the judicial notice statute in Wisconsin as it applies to criminal cases. So this is really a challenge to the jury instruction. This case is not about the propriety of taking judicial notice in this case and whether that was proper. Mr. Harvey has conceded that this was an adjudicative fact, whether Penn Park is a city park, and has conceded that is the type of fact for which the court could take judicial notice. So there's really no question here on that. What we are dealing with is the jury instruction, which in Wisconsin, the court instructs the jury that it shall accept a judicially noticed fact as true, regardless of whether it's a civil case or a criminal case, and that is distinguished from the federal rule of evidence, which makes a distinction between criminal and civil cases. So I wanted to clarify that point. And I guess I would like to touch on a few points that came up during Mr. Weiss's argument, one of which was the propriety of judicial notice on appeal. Can the Court of Appeals take judicial notice? And it seems to me, from what I could find on this topic, there is sort of a split of authority on whether a Court of Appeals or an appellate court can take judicial notice of something when it's an element if the trial court has not passed on that question, if the trial court was not asked to take judicial notice or did not take judicial notice of that question. There seems to be some sort of authority over whether the Court of Appeals can now take judicial notice of that element. Some courts seem to find that by doing so, the Court of Appeals would totally be removing that element from the jury's consideration altogether. But there are a few courts that have found judicial notice, that an appellate court can take judicial notice of an element, even if that element wasn't otherwise proven in the trial court by testimony or judicial notice or other type of evidence. So I think that is somewhat unclear. In Wisconsin, I haven't been able to find any cases where this has been specifically addressed with respect to the propriety of an appellate court taking judicial notice of an element. There is case law in Wisconsin and other jurisdictions that it is proper for an appellate court to take judicial notice of venue, even though that was not proven in the trial court. But Wisconsin case law also establishes that venue is not really an element of an offense. So there's some distinction there. It's something that the state has to prove beyond reasonable doubt, but it's not treated really as an element.
Also, based on your opposing counsel's discussion with Prende, just tell me what the state's position is and why you think that the Prende case does not apply. Because when I look at this, Prende seems to say that any fact that increases a penalty for a crime must be submitted to the jury. It also, that's what we're talking about, we have the Verdi's argument on the penalty enhancer. And also, the character of the Apprendi case compared, there was a statute there, there's a statute here, there's judicial notice taken, and why wouldn't Apprendi apply to these facts?
I think there are a variety of reasons. First of all, Apprendi was not a judicial notice case. It did not involve or taking judicial notice of an indisputable adjudicative fact that could have been judicial notice. It dealt with a hate crime statute, which was something that was totally removed from the jury and was placed in the hands of the court at sentencing. It gave the court at sentencing the authority to decide what they found to be really an element of the offense. It was not the type of thing that could have been judicially noticed. So I think that's an important distinction. The entire penalty enhancer in Apprendi was removed from the jury's consideration altogether. And I would argue that in this case, the court's instruction did not interfere with the jury's fact-finding because the entire offense and the penalty enhancer were submitted to the jury for determination. The jury still had to find the underlying offense, that this offense occurred within 1,000 feet of the designated park, Penn Park, and also still had to find that Penn Park is a city park. It was all submitted to the jury. While it was told, the jury in this case was told to accept as true that Penn Park is a city park. I think Justice Crooks touched on this. The jury still had to actually find that.
But what if the evidence in this case was that the school is located at X spot or X intersection, and the transaction occurred across the street, but there was no evidence that where the transaction occurred was within 1,000 feet, but we know that he was at a bus stop across the street. Would the court take judicial notice that the bus stop was within 1,000 feet of the school, and therefore the jury must find that the transaction occurred within 1,000 feet?
I think the within 1,000 feet part of it falls within the definition of an adjudicative fact. It's a fact. Well, that's maybe a closer call, because to be able to be judicially noticed, it has to be basically something within the court's common knowledge, and that certainly wouldn't be true.
It's undisputable that the bus...
It has to be something that the accuracy of that element can be determined by resort to sources whose accuracy...
There's a survey of the city which shows that bus stop is 802 feet, and that survey is a public document of which judicial notice can be taken.
I think, if there were a document such as the Chief Justice is referring to, that the trial court could say, there's this document out here that says this is 802 feet. That's something I can take judicial notice of that fact. I think that would be entirely proper.
And you don't have to give it to the jury. You can direct the jury that it is 802 feet and it is a school or it is a park.
Well, I'd make a distinction.
That's your question.
I'd like to clarify one point with respect to that. You can instruct the jury that I'm taking judicial notice that this bus stop is 802 feet from the school. You are directed to accept that fact as true. I would argue, however, that that's not directing a verdict. It's different in the sense that...
Not directing a verdict of guilt or innocence or acquittal, but it's directing an element of the offense, or here the enhancement, is it not?
It's directing them to find a certain element. However,
aren't there just a load of cases, let's just go back to elements and take out enhancement, that say you can't direct a jury or the trier of fact as to an element of the offense?
There are cases that do say that, but I think the distinction needs to be made between judicial notice and a directed verdict. Because when a verdict is directed against a party, it's because there's no evidence from which the jury could find for that party. But to be judicially noticed, an element or a fact must be indisputable, not merely undisputed in the particular case. And it seems to me that's an important distinction, because a directed verdict entirely removes it from the jury's consideration. The jury isn't necessarily even instructed on that element. if there really were a directed verdict in this case, the court would, in the presence of the attorney, say, I'm finding as a matter of law Penn Park is a city park. I'm not submitting that element to the jury. We don't need to instruct the jury on that element. Then when the court's giving the instructions and doing the verdict forms, in this case, if it really were a directed verdict, the jury would not have been instructed that it needed to find that Penn, or that this offense occurred within 1,000 feet of Penn Park and to find that it's a city park. Instead, the jury would have just been told, you just need to find that this occurred within 1,000 feet. But here, the jury was still instructed on the offense, on the penalty enhancer, and still instructed that it needed to find that penalty enhancer. And the verdict form required them to answer the question whether they found that this offense occurred within 1,000 feet of Penn Park, a city park. So they still had to find all of the elements. So I think a directed verdict is different in that it's entirely removed from the jury. If this had been a directed verdict and the element was not submitted to the jury in this case, there would have been no need to instruct the jury at all to accept this fact.
What's the difference between not submitting an element to the jury and submitting the element to the jury and instructing them that they are to accept as a matter of law, as established, any facts judicially noticed. Now, I inserted my own words as a matter of law into 90201 sub 7, which states the judge shall instruct the jury to accept as established any facts judicially noticed. I mean, if the jury doesn't do that, then they're not following the judge's instructions, which I suppose could be error. I don't find the difference between not submitting an element to the jury and submitting the element to the jury, but directing that they have to answer it in only one fashion. What's the difference?
It's a tough question. I will tell you that. But I think the right to a trial by a jury does not include the right to have a jury decide an issue contrary to what is indisputable. So I think that's an important fact to keep in mind. The defendant has a right to have, echoing up here, a defendant's right to trial by jury.
And you're not doing anything
wrong.
Requires a jury determination of every element of the offense, and the elements must be submitted to the jury and proven beyond a reasonable doubt. But that right does not include the right to have the jury find contrary to an indisputable matter. And to answer your question, I think that creates an important distinction. When you're directing a verdict, you're wholly removing it from the jury's consideration at all. Here, the jury was still instructed that it had to find the penalty enhancer and it had to find the elements of the enhancer, albeit the jury was told, perhaps, it wasn't given free rein on how to do so. It still had to make a finding. I'm not sure I'm articulating it very well.
Aren't you really bringing whatever it was in your brief that said something about the jury's not entitled to find that the world is flat?
Right, exactly. And I believe that's the Gold case, which I discussed at length in my brief, where the court in that case found exactly that. The jury is not, the constitutional right to a jury trial does not mean that the defendant has a right to have the jury basically decide that the earth is flat. The jury is not free to find contrary to indisputable matters. And that's the difference with judicial notice, is the matter has to be indisputable or it can even take judicial notice of it. In a directed verdict situation, we're not dealing necessarily with indisputable matters. We are dealing with one party failing to meet a burden of proof or failing to provide evidence on the element, but that doesn't necessarily render that element indisputable, which is the difference with judicial notice.
Let me see if I can understand the state's position. The state's position is that a trial court cannot direct the jury to make a finding about facts that are essential for proven element. That's the general rule.
The general rule.
Except where the facts prove an element, the facts are those which a trial court may take judicial notice, then, under those circumstances, the trial court can direct the jury as to finding that fact.
I'm not sure if I would use quite those exact words, but yeah. I think it comes close to what I think I'm trying to say in the sense
you're saying is an exception to the general rules when it's
indisputable, and the right to jury trial does not extend to indisputable matters, and the constitutional right to a jury trial does not include the right to have a jury find something that is indisputable, finding that the earth is flat.
So part of this really relates to nullification, doesn't it?
It does, and part of the rationale for the federal rule, for Congress's version of the federal rule that was ultimately adopted, making the distinction for criminal cases so that juries should be instructed they may but are not required to accept the judicially noticed fact as true, is based on the jury's, they call it right of nullification. But as I pointed out in the brief, Wisconsin doesn't recognize the right of nullification. The power of nullification still exists. But I think what's important to recall here is that even under the Wisconsin rule that requires the jury to be instructed to accept the judicially noticed fact as true, that does nothing to interfere with the power of the jury to nullify on that fact or element or any other fact. It's still submitted to them for their consideration. It's not removed from them entirely, and so the jury could still disregard the judicial notice and nullify on that basis if it were so inclined to do so.
Ms. Herman, I want to understand your position with respect to what are the elements. Is the fact that this is a city park, is that an element here?
The state has conceded throughout this case that, based on case law, including Apprendi, and I've forgotten the name, but there are several Wisconsin cases too that talk about penalty enhancers becoming elements of the offense. And I think my opponent, Mr. Weiss, is correct. Whether you call it a subpart of an element or a separate element, I don't know that that is. The state agrees that whether it's a city park or a state park or some kind of park, it has to be one of those kind of specifically enumerated parks, and the state has the burden to prove that element.
So it is an element.
Right.
Under Scalia's and Thomas's, I guess they were concurrences, is there any question that how this case would come out?
I'm not sure I understand your question exactly.
Well, I guess it's sort of a...
I'm not familiar entirely with their
concurrences. It's not important to this case. I was fascinated by their
Thomas's statement that Scalia joined in, that the majority did not go far enough in Apprendi, and that, in fact, any element that increases the penalty should is not a break from past law at all.
Right, and I suppose there's a question, and I think there's a continuing debate in the U.S. Supreme Court as well as Wisconsin courts. I try to trace the history of this and figure this out over whether it could be harmless error to so instruct the jury in a case such as this. The state has not specifically argued harmless error in its brief, in part because I think it's somewhat unclear from the case law on how this court would have to come out on the question of harmless error. On the one hand, in this case, it certainly seems like there could be some kind of harmless error argument because Mr. Harvey has never challenged or tried to, or could he, that Penn Park is a city park. He's never tried to show that Penn Park is anything other than a city park. And since we know that's indisputable and that it is a city park, there was nothing he could have offered contrary to that. So even if we had the federal rule where even when the court takes judicial notice of a fact, the party against whom that fact is judicially noticed may present contrary evidence and the jury can be instructed that it may, but is not required to accept that fact as true, I'm hard-pressed to see how that really would have made a difference in this case because there would have been nothing Mr. Harvey could have presented to show that this is anything other than a city park. So,
except that ignores the fact that if the judge improperly took judicial notice of Penn Park as a city park or its status as a city park, then there's a complete failure of the proof.
That's sort of the other side of the coin that I was getting to as to why I don't know how this would come out on a harmless error analysis. There are other cases that say the real problem is the wrong person decided.
What is the authority for the proposition that the court can take notice, judicial notice, of an adjudicative fact which constitutes an element of the offense or an element of the penalty?
There are cases, I don't know if I can tell you them right off the top of my head, but I know there are several cases in other jurisdictions that have found it's fine to take judicial notice of an element. Nothing specifically precludes taking judicial notice of an element simply because it's an element. It all falls with whether it's within the definition of an adjudicative fact. Is it something that you can look to some source that can't be challenged, the accuracy of which can't be challenged to establish that fact, or if it's something that is known within the territorial jurisdiction of the court, even if it's an element, courts have not had a problem with taking judicial notice of something merely because it's an element. And this goes back to the very first point I made. It really comes down to how the court is instructed to deal with the judicially noticed fact, even if it's an element.
Has the U.S. Supreme Court ever squarely addressed that issue?
I'm not sure that the U.S. Supreme Court has squarely addressed the issue of judicial notice of an element. I can't come up with a case right now, but I am aware of cases in other jurisdictions, some of which are the cases that I looked at to see what a court, an appellate court, can do as far as taking judicial notice of an element, even when the trial court did not. And those cases, and I could provide those to the court if the court would like that. I unfortunately don't have the names of the cases or sites right at my fingertips, but I'd be happy to provide those.
Did you brief that? I don't recall that it was briefed because that wasn't the crux of your argument in the briefs. You pretty much went right to the judicial notice statute. Right. And there was a footnote, I recall, in your brief about whether this is an adjudicative fact and whether that has any bearing on whether it's also an elemental fact. But I happen to think that this is a critical distinction under and under the Sixth Amendment analysis. I mean, if the Sixth Amendment right to a jury trial includes the right to have the jury, not the judge, determine all elements of the offense, and under Apprendi, all elements of a penalty enhancer, then we get right to the distinction that was raised in Justice Babich's questions, Justice Bradley's questions, and the Chief's questions about whether there's any distinction between the court saying, I find, and the court saying to the jury, you must find. You know, it's sort of glass half empty, glass half full. So if you do have that authority, perhaps we could have it.
Yeah, I would be happy to provide the court with, I know I found some cases where the courts have found it is okay to take judicial notice of something even if it is an element. I'm not, like I said, I'm not aware of a U.S. Supreme Court case.
Okay, why don't you provide those to us in letter brief with a copy to the public defender, whether it be Ms. Maroney or Mr. Weiss. And Mr. Weiss, you have you may respond to that again by letter brief. Can we do this pretty promptly, Ms. Arms?
Certainly.
Within next week?
Certainly.
And you respond within 3 or 4 days after you get it? Okay, you each get a week. Ms. Herman, within a week. Mr. Weiss, respond within a week.
Even if it's Christmas Day.
And the Department of Justice is moving to a new building next week, but I will certainly be able to get it done probably by the end of this week.
But this is a case in which, well, go ahead.
I guess I'd like to move on to a few other points. One of which came up during Mr. Weiss's argument, and that is the remedy in this case. And I'd like to touch on that. What Harvey has asked for in this case is that the penalty enhancer be vacated, and as Mr. Weiss explained, the effect of the penalty enhancer in this case was that he's not parole eligible for 3 years. He is not seeking resentencing, and he's not seeking a new trial. But I just would like to point out that the state believes under State versus Pete and State versus Thiel that the state would not be precluded from going back and retrying Mr. Harvey on the penalty enhancer. That would not pose a double jeopardy violation because, as Thiel and Pete point out, when it is a trial error, not a question of insufficiency of the evidence, and trial errors include erroneous jury instructions, if this court were to so find that there's a problem with the jury instruction in Wisconsin on judicial notice in criminal cases, then this is not, there would be no double jeopardy problem with retrying on the penalty enhancer in this case. And Mr. Weiss touched a little bit on resentencing and whether that may be necessary. As I said, he has not specifically requested that in this case on behalf of Mr. Harvey. However, the state could see how that might be the proper subject of a motion for sentence modification, as Mr. Weiss explained. If the judge's sentence was based on half of the available maximum, and now that available maximum has changed, it's possible. I'm not sure whether it would be appropriate in this case since the maximum never really came into play. The mandatory minimum came into play.
Does the analysis change at all? You focus in your oral argument about an erroneous jury instruction, but in your brief and other places, it's obvious that 90201 sub 7 is a statute that plays into that jury instruction. In other words, that jury instruction exists because it follows the dictates of 902.017. Is the analysis different if you frame the issue as an erroneous jury instruction as opposed to an unconstitutional statute?
The analysis as far as just generally the analysis, whether it's different.
Standard of review is different.
Right. I mean, he's challenging the constitutionality of a statute, which does present a different standard of review. It places the burden on him to establish beyond a reasonable doubt that the statute, or at least this portion of the statute, is unconstitutional. So I think that's right, that we're dealing with the unconstitutionality of a portion of a statute that talks about jury instructions. So it may not be simply a question of instructional error, but whether this type of instruction is constitutional or not. And I don't believe that he has established in this case, beyond a reasonable doubt, that this portion of the judicial notice statute is unconstitutional. And as I pointed out in my brief, the U.S. Supreme Court adopted a version of the rule that is the version the Wisconsin court ultimately adopted. Being aware of this constitutional debate out there, and this suggests that the U.S. Supreme Court did not find any problem with this version of the rule, Congress sort of erred on the side of caution, thinking it might pose a problem to the Sixth Amendment right to a jury trial, but even Congress wasn't convinced that it was for sure a violation of that right, an actual violation. And I guess I would just like to wrap up by pointing out just a few more points here. Taking judicial notice in this case did not relieve the state of its burden of proving all of the elements beyond a reasonable doubt, because in Wisconsin, judicial notice is a form of evidence as defined in the jury instruction on evidence, and judicial notice is the manner in which that element is proven beyond a reasonable doubt. And again, in this case, I would also just like to briefly touch on the two other points that Mr. Harvey has raised in the brief, and that is dealing really with whether the trial court misused its discretion in this case by failing to explain the basis for taking judicial notice. As I pointed out in my brief, those arguments are waived by not being raised in the petition for review and not being raised at trial or in the Court of Appeals. However, even on the merits, I explained in my brief that maybe ideally the trial court should explain what sources it's referring to when it's taking judicial notice. But Harvey never disputed that Penn Park is a city park and never questioned the court's source for that information. And the Court of Appeals correctly explained that this was an indisputable fact. It was an adjudicative fact, thus the accuracy of which could be determined, as it did, by resort to things like the website, all the city parks division, those kinds of things. So if there are no further questions, thank the court for their time.
Thank you, Ms. Herman. Mr. Weiss, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Do you have any comments you want to make on the double jeopardy issue?
On the double jeopardy issue?
Yeah.
Certainly I do. It's one of the areas I did want to touch briefly upon. Our position is that certainly this is a new argument that was never made in the briefs in the Court of Appeals or this court previously. However, I don't think that this is a situation akin to Pete or to Field. If the court recollects, Pete was about the weapons enhancer, where this court created a new rule of law explaining that there had to be a specific definition attached to that. and then allowed for a retrial under that new definition. It was a new element that had to be proven to the jury. The same in Thiel was 90 days prior to release in the 980 situation, and the court, for the first time, said, and this specifically was remanded to the Court of Appeals, and it was decided that this was a new interpretation of the statute requiring proof of this previously unknown element. In this case, I don't think that's true. The states conceded that it had to prove both things. It would not be a new ruling of law from this court that, oh, in addition to proving this, you must also prove that. So I think that there could not be a retrial in this case because there was a trial and there was no evidence, and on sufficiency you cannot simply remand if the issue was tried. That said, I would like to address a few other points. Justice Babbage's question about, well, if you had a plot map, I think Justice Abramson added the map analogy to the 1,000 feet, well, couldn't a judge direct a verdict on the 1,000 feet? And under the state's view, yeah, the court could do that. The trial judge could do that. So what the state's really suggesting, if you follow out where they're going to it doesn't have to be out to the horizon, just a baby step from where we are. If the state's correct that the trial court can take judicial notice that Penn Park is a park and tell the jury you must find Penn Park was a city park within the statute, and in answer to Justice Babbage's question, the judge can also take judicial notice and tell the jury you must find a disregard within 1,000 feet, I don't know what's left. Anytime we start allowing judges to take judicial notice of elements, we're on a very, very slippery slope.
What about the state's argument that this that judicial notice is just an evidentiary rule and it's just one method of proof? And so when the state asks and the court agrees to take judicial notice of something, even if it's an element, it hasn't been relieved of its burden of proof, the jury is still in the driver's seat.
The jury is absolutely not in the driver's seat. And I think the state is almost, I don't want to say in a malevolent way, misrepresenting its own position here. But by suggesting that the jury has an option, the state is simply not really fessing up to what happens. The trial judge, in this case, directed, to use the very word direct, the court was a quote from the jury instructions at page 302 of the trial. The court has taken judicial notice of certain facts, and you are directed to accept the following as true. I don't believe that's giving the jury any options here. The jury is required by law to follow the instructions of the court. And at page 17 of the state's brief, the state criticizes the federal rule by saying words to the effect that, well, the federal rule that allows for this permissive inference rather than a mandatory direction is open to criticism. It defeats the purpose of judicial notice, the state writes. Because the state absolutely wants judicial notice to be a directed verdict. That's exactly what's wrong with it. And if the state's suggesting now that they're not really saying that, they are really saying that because it says right here, it defeats the purpose of judicial notice if you allow the jury a permissive inference there. So I don't see how they're possibly separated.
So when it comes to an element of the offense or an element of the penalty enhancer, taking judicial notice of that is tantamount to it.
I think in every case, absolutely. And I think we need a bright line rule that says that. Because going back to Justice Babbage's point, where do we draw the line? If they can take judicial notice of the 1,000 feet and they can take judicial notice of the park, how is that not running afoul of Apprendi when the judge has decided all of the facts relevant to the penalty enhancer? It can't be a little bit on this. I'm afraid we have to have a hard line, and we don't cross it. To our credit, you know, Wisconsin has always been out ahead on requiring juries to find penalty enhancers, and that's where this court's Pete decision is exactly on point in Pete. The court said, no, the jury has to find these things. We were way out ahead on weapons enhancers, for example. We did not have an Apprendi problem in Wisconsin, and I would urge this court not to create one. My lights are on. I'll sit down and write my brief.
Right. Thank you. Mr. Weiss, you'll sit down, but you're going to stand up soon, I think.
I did have one minor question. Normally the appellant would sit over here. I'm also counsel in the next case. Would you prefer to move or may I stay put?
Here.
Okay, thanks.
Court cares, they'll advise you. But